Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
So, guys, you've opted to come to a workshop on governance around mutualisation. So I'm first of all keen to understand why you're interested in this topic and what you want to go away with, and then we can then work together, because it's a fairly small group, to just go through some of the issues. And they encourage us not to bring presentations, so I haven't brought you my 6 million slides of what I could tell you everything about social enterprises and mutualism governance. So let's just whip round and see who you are and what you're interested in, and then we can pick up from there. Do you want to start, Phil?
I'm Phil Woods from Cornwall Council. I head up the scrutiny section within the Democratic Services side of things. So I'm just trying to get an understanding about the way our authorities is heading. As you heard earlier, a colleague of mine, Sophie, saying about how much we're doing in terms of ALMOs, about trusts in terms of leisure, and all these other things are being set up, arms length companies and all that sort of stuff. So really, I just came mostly to hear about the scrutiny side today. All these other things are being set up, arms length companies and all that sort of stuff. So really, I just came mostly to hear about the scrutiny side today, but also just to experience all of it, really. So about how accountability in terms of how we can get the members to keep account of as much as possible.
Okay, and are you interested more around accountability between providers and commissioners of public services, or particularly around accountability in social enterprises? Because I'm happy either way.
Yeah, well, I mean, both, to be honest, I don't think I'm exclusive on one or the other.
Okay.
I think the way that we are as an authority is that I need to get a firm understanding on both equally, because we are being asked to keep everyone to account, not just the ones that sit firmly within our remit.
Yeah, good. Okay. Sorry, I haven't got a badge on, so I can't.
It's nothing to attach on the top, says down here. My name is Hannah Jameson. I am from an organisation called the IPA, and we're a small research and consultancy organisation, charity, social enterprise. And we do a lot of research into a lot of these kind of new mutuals models, or different forms of public service delivery organisations, not just mutuals or anything. So we produce a lot of research and help support organisations, but a lot focused on the practicalities of setting up new organisations and how you work public servants to change the culture, change them into entrepreneurs, engage them in their new mission. So we're quite focused on the nuts and bolts of it, and do a lot of work in that. But what I'm hoping to think about it through this session is more from the kind of accountability point of view. It's not something that we focus on hugely. It's not the kind of angle that we have today. So I'm just trying to
think about sense of what we mean by accountability.
Yeah, yeah.
And you say you're a charity social, and you went charity social enterprise. So,
we're a limited company and a charity.
Right. Where does your income come from?
We're a membership organisation. So
okay.
A lot of private. Most of our work is private.
And who
sectors.
Are your shareholders?
Don't have any shareholders.
You're limited by guarantee. Members.
So members, a lot of consultancy, a lot of commissioned work from central government mainly, into research.
So grant funded.
Not necessarily grant, but contracted.
Okay.
Commissioned.
That's useful. We'll probably touch on a bit of that, because I think that brings in some interesting dimensions about financial accountability and who you accountable to for different things. So.
My name's Anna Groves, and I'm Chief Exec at Harborough Council, which is a small rural district in Leicestershire, just south of Leicester. Very rural, not deprived in any way, very affluent. I'm here for a multitude of reasons. One, we've just embarked on a major transformation programme. around leadership and culture, both with councillors and officers. We have a budget gap to fill. We want to change the way we're working. We have a what I call a mixed economy of approaches. We have shared partnerships already. We have leisure trusts already. We have normal contracts. But this particular area around social enterprise is not an area the council has necessarily engaged with. If I'm honest, and I think more people need to be honest, I don't know what it means. So I want to understand that in a lot more detail, because I need to know whether... I mean, we have a very articulate and informed community. It's not an experience I've had before. They know more about commissioning than I do, which is really quite scary when you go to public meetings. And because usually you're the one that knows more than the audience. So I do know about commissioning, but what they were talking about were these social enterprises, and they are the very sort of people that will engage with them and set them up. So I'm seeing our community as a great asset, but I don't have officers who can harness that at the moment. So it's all part of our transformation programme.
What's your, I mean, you say a very sort of well-informed population. Do they have a sort of a general background? So have you got, you know, masses of accountants or masses of... because they knew what they were doing.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely, knew what they were doing.
But what I'd like to do is be able to use them as an asset and see how we can improve our improvement agenda through our community.
Okay, we'll let you settle in first and come back to you. We're just trying to find out.
I'm Henry Peterson, ex-local government. I worked for Hammersmith and Fulham for many years. Since then, I've been working as an independent consultant, mainly for the LGA, Local Government Improvement and Development, and London Councils, and local government-related bodies, some stuff on health. A lot of my work's been on partnership working, LAAs originally, total place, community budgets. So I'm quite interested in the applicability of mutuals to commissioning bodies. And I mean, if you think back to the history of local strategic partnerships, they never had any statutory status. I've often wondered whether they might have done better had they turned themselves into community interest companies or adopted some form of legal status, which would at least have given them some capacity to make decisions in their own right, rather than always having to rely on authorities. So the agenda around health and wellbeing boards, clinical commissioning groups, complicated, ever more complicated accountability relationships that all that will involve. So, but also on the provider side in terms of spin-outs and mutuals in health and local government.
And what we'll weave into that is I've been doing some thinking and some work on investment vehicles, commissioning investment vehicles.
Local investment trusts and things.
Very much so. So that links in with that conversation, which is good. Tom.
Hi, I'm Tom Howard. I'm here from Clearly So. We are a social business. We are a network of helping social businesses, social enterprises, offering them business services, help them get investment. A lot of what they come to us wanting. We also work with corporations who are looking to get involved in the sector, either through their kind of CSR agendas or on a grander scale, hopefully in the future. So I suppose from personal, I don't really know much about this area at all, but so from a Clearly So perspective, we're probably looking, as we are generally representing social businesses and enterprises, helping them get work through commissioning. So we're coming from their point of view, trying to find out a bit more about how the accountability, the council point of view will come, will work into for them trying to get work through. A lot of them are moving away, maybe from the public sector, because they feel it's too messy, it's too difficult for them, whereas the private sector or public consumers is an easier target market for them.
When you said you were from Clearly So, I was going to say you could sit here actually, because you know this stuff as well as I do. You don't know much about it. What don't you know much about? How the public sector deals with accountability?
And especially as this is a new social enterprises specifically, and obviously it's being pushed a lot at the moment. How that is going to work for both sides in maintaining. I know a lot of people are nervous about it. Handing it over to social enterprises, both publicly and organisation, so our point would just be learning about what are the issues from your point of view, hopefully passing that on to social businesses so they can be more aware when they're applying to commissioning work.
Okay.
I'm Matt,
so I've got bad eyesight as well, so I have to squint.
I'm an overview and screening officer in the London Borough of Hackney.
Mm-hmm.
I
know Tim well.
We are Tim
Shields.
We're not a borough which looks very much at outsourcing any services, mutualisation, much at the moment. But I think my interests are shared with some of the earlier comments, you know, about how does the relationships operate in accountability? How do people understand, how do the different bodies involved understand their role in providing a public service and who it is that they should be answering to when things go, if things go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And actually if things go right as well, that's really
wrong,
important.
Things will go wrong.
Right, okay. Yeah. But also then, who takes the credit when things go right as well? Because there's a lot of learning from that.
Yeah.
And then I think so what you said over there, a bit of an understanding perhaps more about what the opportunities are around opening up social enterprise. You know, the community works challenge is something which I find very interesting.
Yeah.
But I don't know, there's a lot of talk about localism.
Mm.
It's probably not as much talk about municipalism, which is, you know, taking things down to the lowest democratically responsive levels. And so a bit more of an understanding about what the benefit is of pushing things further and further down to their capital.
Mm. Okay. Teresa, do you mind calling Teresa?
No.
we were just sort of saying who we were and what we wanted out of this session.
Right.
I heard who you were. And
I'm here on behalf of one of my organisations that I'm a member of, but I've got many hats. But usually I'm an older person's representative in that scenario, and also being an older person myself, all the pitfalls and things around it. Because one of the things that I've got a bit of a problem with at the moment, I'm also a member of Change Agent, Older People's Advisory Group UK,
okay.
And they are a co-op now, and therefore it's a whole different ballgame from when they used to be Better Government for Older People.
Yeah.
So I'm having problems getting my head around the whole business of co-ops.
Yes.
And also about the rights of the individual in that process. And where you sort of take it to if you've got a problem. That's one thing. The other thing is I'm also chair of the Ransack Association, which is an education. The project is actually an educational adventure for older people.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we, last year we did our constitution, and this year we got the intellectual property rights. And go forward and become either a community of interest or social enterprise, whatever.
Whatever, but you don't know what you want to be yet. All right, okay.
Well,
there's probably something, if you leave me your contact details, I'm just writing something at the moment about how you choose the right governance
model.
We've
been told you've got to do a business plan.
You have, unfortunately.
Can I just add something else as well? Because when you were talking in the presentation, I had the leader of my council sat next to me, and I thought it was really interesting to see the reaction to that, and I know I'm being tight. But I think the issue for me as a chief exec is when you are looking at new service delivery models, which is what we are doing, is how you get that political buy-in.
Yeah.
How you are able to deal with risk aversion and deal with accountability within it.
Yeah.
And I think until I can work through that.
Yeah. No, you're not me anyway. Right, I'm going to scribble because it's the way I think best, which means I'm going to, move the microphone, which might mean it'll go off. And when I start, I will warn you, I am dyslexic, which is why I'm so creative. And I also wear hearing aids, so I don't hear you. I will fiddle with my ears. It's not mean that they're itchy, it means I'm turning my hearing aids on. Right, that is a huge lot of issues there, and we could probably spend all day going through those. But I think where we start, let's just myth bust a little bit, because we keep talking about social enterprise, mutuals, co-ops, charities, and one of the things you were saying, Anna, is what are they? The first myth busting is where we're saying central government is pushing social enterprise. Central government is not pushing social enterprise. Central government is pushing developing a mixed market economy. All right? So basically, Francis Maud, who's a fantastic chap, met him several times, I had a lot of time for him, and I'm not just saying that because I'm being recorded, I really do think he's a great chap. There is a clear recognition, and local authorities have had this recognition for a lot of years, because, you know, I come from a health background, and health is very monopolistic. Local authorities have always had mixed markets of provision, because A, you had to, because you were all shoved out in competitive tendering, and B, because that's just generally the nature of the work. So, what central government isn't saying is everybody should go out there and mutualise. What it's saying is, actually, the best way to have good patient choice, good user choice, better quality, is to make sure that there is a market from which to choose from. Because at the moment, in some situations, there isn't a market. You know, if you want to go and do something, we see this. I mean, I had an issue with my electric company a few weeks ago, and I told them I was going to change supplier because they just wouldn't listen to me about billing. And did they respond to me? They couldn't care less, actually. When they sent me a customer survey and I put on it, this has been my issue, I tried to speak to somebody, they didn't deal with it because they could only work to script. I tried to talk to somebody else. I'm going to have 6 months to work out what my usage, then I'm going to switch provider. Have they emailed me? No. Why? Because it's quite monopolistic. You know, it's not a lot of choice where there's any difference. So one of the things government's trying to do is create a marketplace where individuals' needs can be met through vehicles that they choose to use, because there is a different option for them to choose from different things. So the first issue about saying, you know, is government trying to make everybody into a social enterprise, and should councils or public sector, etc., all go down that route? No, they're not. What they're trying to do is get us to think a little bit differently. So let's just focus on social enterprise then. So all a social enterprise is, in its purest sense, is something that is not a public sector organisation or a pure private sector organisation. Right? It may deliver public services, but it is not a public sector organisation. It is constituted as a business. So it is a business, and it's a business that can deliver public services. It could deliver other things as well. And therefore, its accountability goes to where? Who are we accountable to when we provide public services?
Local authority.
So initially, isn't it, it's the person who buys it, be that police commissioner, local authority commissioner, be that PCT, be that health authority, and then ultimately to the Secretary of State. So it goes all the way up, doesn't it?
But it's also accountable to the people that use it.
Very much so. So it's accountable down, isn't it? Okay. If you're a business, who are you legally accountable to?
Shareholders.
Yep. And who else? Who do you register with as a business? Company's house. Yep. Now, a social enterprise then has two sets of people that they're accountable to. I mean, they obviously have all the subsets of that. But as a social enterprise, they have to go up that way, and they have to go up that way. And they've also got the regulators, if they deliver public services. So things like, if you're a health one, you've got in social services, you have to report into the CQC. I would imagine there's other ones, I don't know which other bodies that your service is reporting into, but certainly from a healthcare perspective, social care perspective, you have the CQC. And also, like any business, you've still got people like health and safety exec, you've still got... So all of those things are still there. It's just the relationship between them are slightly different.
Is there something specific about social enterprise and profit?
Right, so okay, so this in terms of governance is accountability. In terms of profit, if you think about what I said earlier on about these are social businesses, so there's different types of... We use social enterprise to mean all sorts of different things. We use them to mean social businesses, which for my definition of a social business is it's a business, it's like a shop, and it generates income, and it uses that income to deliver services, and then it makes a decision about what it's doing with its surplus. And predominantly what happens with that surplus is it's the majority of that surplus is reinvested back into social purposes, back into social good. Just shout at me.
It was the conflict of interest.
Yeah.
Say, I'll give you the example of Age UK, for example.
Yeah.
They've got retail on, they do services,
yeah,
et cetera, et cetera. So how can they contradict some of the things they put out, saying they're just about onto people?
Well, it depends what your social business does. And again, it goes back into how do you prevent conflicts of interest in your own business. So the first, just let's go back to the money first of all, because it helps. So there's social businesses, i.e. they're exactly the same as a Tesco's or a, you know, local high street fruit and vegetable shop. The only difference about them is that when they generate profit, and I use surplus versus profit, because a lot of people get really caught up in profit and surplus. When they've got money left, when they've paid all their bills and they've got they've pumped, primed it into their next lot of development, it's what they do with that surplus that makes the difference.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first part. The second part of it is the way in which they invest internally into delivery. All right?
Mm.
So social businesses typically do two things. One of the things they will do is if they're a legal structure under Companies House called a KIC, Community Interest Company, which is where people often get caught up, the KIC regulator says 65% of your surplus has to be reinvested back into your social objects, your social purpose.
Mm-hmm.
But the company itself defines what that social purpose is. All right. Now, the KIC regulations are fairly accessible to read. They're fairly clear. So if you want to pull them off, you can find them on the web. They're only a few pages long. They're really easy to read. It's one of the only sets of regulations I find easy to read. The problem with KICs is that if you have an organisation that needs to raise money to do things on the investment market, so I'll clearly so chappies there, and you want to go to a private investor to either give you money to buy equipment, so capital for equipment, or you've got a building that needs refurbishing, or you want to expand, there's not a lot of appetite out there. The social investors will do it. But the equity market, the investors, look at the business and say, there's not much money in there for me, so why would I want to invest in you? Okay. So one of the reasons why we get caught up in should it be a KIC, should it be something else, is the first thing we always say is tell us what you're there to do and what you need to do. Because if you need, you know, to create a group of nurses that want to set up a social enterprise looking after children on respirators, so kids that are really poorly, that are always on... ventilators, they need lots of capital. The last thing they need to be is a KIC, because they're not going to get private investors wanting to invest in them.
So can a council use its reserves to invest in
this? Yes, you can. Okay, and we're just doing this with Right, so a social enterprise is a social business. You also get people calling social enterprises charities. So what's a charity?
Not-for-profit.
They always say they're not-for-profit.
No.
They can't be not-for-profit these days, can you? You have to get income in, and you have to have some surplus to keep you afloat. You have to have some reserves. And that's the problem with some of the charities at the moment, is because everybody calls them not-for-profit, they don't operate as businesses, and therefore when you hit a problem, they haven't got enough money in the bank. It's a bit like your savings, isn't it? You know, you save for a rainy day for when things go a bit wrong. And there's some fantastic charities out there that have done that, but the ones that tend to be falling over a little bit is because their grants have been cut, they've been really reliant on grants, and they haven't got the money in the bank to survive. Is that your experiences, Teresa?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
not go into too much.
No, 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 don't, because we've been recorded as we've been recorded as well. So we just be, we did remind everybody of that.
But you can obviously, I am the company or the organisation I work for is a charity registered as a charity.
Yeah.
Have all those obligations. Obviously, a limited company by guarantee, so do report to company
yeah.
and so on. You can make a surplus. You can reinvest that.
You certainly can.
You can, and we're not profit. We don't call it profit, but we have a surplus. We invest back in.
Yeah. It's
you know,
doable.
Our capital or our whatever we need
yeah.
to grow to so on.
You can do it. There is nothing to stop you doing it. But the culture and the mentality is
yeah.
different.
We don't have a.
Yeah.
You know, we work mostly with businesses, and so we have that same mindset.
Yeah.
We think like a business,
yeah.
but we don't have shareholders.
So charitable status gives you certain VAT and tax reliefs, hence why you're not allowed to generate too much profit, because if you generate too much profit, you look like a business, and therefore you start paying business rates, corporation tax and VAT. That's the only reason.
Yeah.
So again, what we're starting to see are people having hybrid models where you can actually play some really clever plays with here and say you have your social enterprise here, you have your local authority there, and you have a charitable trust there. And this organisation invests its surplus into this organisation, it gives it, it mitigates the tax, and that funds certain things that this organisation would potentially need to do. So there's ways in which you can move the money around the system that complies with tax rules. But, you know, because it's about the most efficient use of money, isn't it, and resources. So social enterprises can all be charities, and then you hear all these lovely things like limited by guarantee, limited by share, employee-owned organisations, co-ops, etc., etc. Just because they're called one of those things doesn't mean to say they reinvest their profit back into social good. All right? So, famous employee organisation is which? Which one do you see all the time?
John Lewis.
John Lewis. Okay, how does John Lewis operate? Anybody know?
It's a bit like a council.
Every employee trust.
Yep.
They're constituted,
they've got a board.
They've got the same structure.
Yeah, what do they do with their profits?
Give it back to the employees.
Yeah. Which employees?
All of them.
They all get some. If you're the cleaning lady, yeah, they all get different percentages. So there's a really, if you do, I mean, I think John Lewis model is fantastic. If you do a web search, a Google search, I found the other day quite a very interesting document that tells you about the remuneration of different levels of people and what they do. So John Lewis model works in that you get people are invest in the business. But equally, Tesco's have an employee ownership model. I've got a sister-in-law, trying to think what she was then, who works in Tesco's, who, whenever she comes to my house, she opens my cupboards and says, why haven't you been shopping at Tesco's? I told you before. Because that affects my shares.
Mm.
Because she has shares in the company. She's allowed to use some of her salary to buy shares in the company. They're allowed to buy so many shares. And it's her pension, basically.
That's
so she wants
BT.
Me.
BT
yeah.
have the same thing.
Yeah.
They've stopped that now, haven't they?
Yeah. So you could say, actually, Tesco's is a hybrid employee-owned organisation because they're absolutely, fundamentally reinvesting their profit back into their workforce because the more shares they get, the more business they create, the better they deliver the service, the more return they're going to get. So I suppose the tale of this is, when we actually say social enterprise, what are we meaning? And what I mean when I talk about social enterprise is social businesses. What you can also have underneath that are, you know, you've got co-ops. So all co-ops are collections of people in a governance model that come together to invest in that business and deliver that business. And the old Green Shield stamps was the cooperative model, wasn't it? And I'm still old enough to remember the co-op book and the little blue stamps, weren't
what
they? Used to get
yeah, what happened to them?
Penny with a penny, you used to get a penny for every time you spent so much money. Anybody else remember?
I remember Green Shield stamps.
Yeah.
Was that different?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Co-op stamps.
Remember the co-op.
So co-op stamps. When you went in the co-op, you spent so much money. I can't remember how much you had to spend, but you used to get a little stamp that you kept in a book,
yeah.
and then
I
you used to take.
The other day, but
did you? Used to take the books, didn't you? And then you used to go and say, "I want a tin of milk, or I want some toilet paper."
Oh,
and here's my. It's a bit like Tesco's club card vouchers,
a bit like
but
the Nectar card.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there are different models of around, but the key point here is about saying we're talking about accountability. So this is how the model works, and accountability you can see is quite different depending on what this business does and how it works. So the key issue for scrutiny and for getting it through mechanisms to make sure the accountability works is, first of all, you know, this business, if it's a social business delivering public services, it has a whole set of director responsibilities to Companies House. And believe me, they are a lot more challenging than this. In that, as a director, I'm a director of local partnerships, as a director of a commercial company, I can end up in a lot more trouble if I don't run this business viably, sustainably. I've got enough cash in the bank to pay everybody because there's nobody to bail me out. All right? The trouble with these services is that you can get individual services, or you can equally get public sector organisations. You look at health. You know, how many times do we hear that hospitals are in deficit or someone else is in deficit? Mm. What happens is the public sector at large bail them out. So the bottom line is actually not the bottom line. If you're in a business, if you don't hit your financial targets and you can't pay your salaries, you go bankrupt.
Are we talking about different forms of accountability there? I'm sure we are, but because obviously the Companies House is purely interested in financial accountability.
No, you've got a whole load of legal statutory duties. Can you just turn that thermostat down behind you?
Whereas the accountability I'm thinking about on the left-hand side of that would be about performance, about, you know, a social business providing a public service and actually how they're performing.
All right, so that for my man is commissioning.
Okay.
So this is legal accountability.
Okay.
All right, so this is legally accountable here. It has a legal accountability here.
Mm.
But it's, I mean, my sense is that it's less, this relationship here is more about being able to deliver to your customer.
Mm.
This relationship here is a legal requirement. And if you don't abide to that legal requirement as a provider, you can end up in jail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you will go bankrupt. You probably won't lose your house because you're a limited partnership. You will be stopped from setting up another business in the future. You'll be blacklisted. Right? You might be the same here. The relationship then between here and here, whilst there is a quasi-legal relationship because you've got to combine with all the health and safety and the CQQC, etc., these people here buying services from you are your customers. You might have an end user, so you might be delivering those services to that user, and they may be your clients or the end user, but your customer, in this sense, is the public sector. They're selling the services to you.
I mean, if you think of the origins of local authorities,
it's
municipal corporations, not-for-profit, established themselves in the 19th century. You know, I've always struggled to see the difference between that and what government now calls a neutral or a social enterprise, this glorious new world.
And did councils at that stage operate in a similar way?
Yes, and when I worked at Hammersmith and Fulham and we got involved in interest rate swaps and suddenly owed $100 million to the banks, a lot of the banks started trying to argue that's what we were in real terms.
Yeah.
A municipal corporation, and the individual councillors could be sued in their own name and in their own right.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of legal argument as to what is a local authority at the end of the day, because although it's a creature of statute and English law, at the end of the day, it's a not-for-profit social business in your language, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, and the limits.
Sorry, I didn't catch on what you're saying, Emery, because there've been a number of articles recently written about the origins of local councils, and it's exactly that.
Yeah.
They were set up as social enterprises that have then morphed into what we now call the public sector.
Yeah.
And I think one of the challenges is how do we go back to those origins? Because that's effectively what we're being asked to do. It may not necessarily be that we need a plethora of different organisations to deliver service, but I think it's the question back to the councils, why have you got so big? Why are you doing things the way you're
doing?
Can
you do things in a better way, in a smaller way?
Do things in a different way, get back to your origins.
Yeah.
So we are looking at those historical documents, believe it or not.
No, I would. And the question I would always have, and it's the argument that went on in health for a lot of years, is can you both be a commissioner and a provider? And my argument is yes. As long as you make sure that you've got the accountability between the buyer and the supplier, as long as you make sure that you know you treat that relationship in the same way as you would treat a relationship with another provider. And as long as you make sure that if you've got provision, that your accountability or governance structures address that provision as well as the buy-in. Because what we're typically seeing is organisations that have a small amount of provision and a big commissioning function focus on commissioning and not provision. And therefore their governance structure isn't right. And it's not, you haven't got the right people in place to be able to say, in order to be able to govern or be accountable as a provider, you've got to have certain things in place. So again, when you're making your assessment and saying which model's best for this service, there's some of the questions you need to ask. Is will our internal governance mechanism enable us to deliver this service in a safe way if it's in-house versus out-house?
I've got some members within my, certainly within my committee, around environment economy, that are starting to ask serious questions about our arm's length company, around our neighbourhood services, and around the value for money that they're getting, because a couple of our councillors, and one of them just happens to be the chairman of a committee, has come along and said, well, I've got an example of where I can get that service at one third of the price if I went out to market and didn't have to come through this arm's length company. And now those questions are starting to come up.
I think things are changing as well in terms of accountability that you talked about, that if you're a director of a company, which I have been, then you can be held accountable at your job and all of that. I think in the public service, chief execs and directors are starting to lose their jobs.
They are.
Around accountability.
Very much so.
You know, and so I do think it has shifted.
Yeah. And that goes back to when someone said earlier on, I think it was Jed before he went, about staff.
Yeah.
And, you know, they, you know, will I still have a job? Will I still have my pension? Well, actually, if you stay in the public sector, will you still be in the same position you are now in 10 years' time? Probably not. You know, so, but it is that fear factor again of people hold on to things. And some of it's about the way you engage. You know, what is it about your terms and conditions you want? What is it about your pension? There are other things out there in the market. Let's have a look. So, just within this model, let's just talk about trading companies, because trading companies are really interesting. So under local authority regulations, you can have these things called trading companies. Okay, so they're sort of, you know, if that's the local authority and you've got provision, I would say the next step on is, you know, you might want to share services with someone else. And one of the other things we see is people setting up these arm's length companies, these under using trading regulations. And then the next step on from there is to become some sort of external organisation, be it a social enterprise or a commercial enterprise or whatever.
Just for, we just got the neighbourhood services role. We've got a Section 95 company and a tech up company.
Right.
So one can externally trade and one can't. So they've gone with best of both, really, and that seemed to sit well with the members. Now it's just starting to be implemented, so we'll see what the future lies, but just for a bit of background.
Yep, no, it's good. So I haven't yet found one of these, apart from one that I've just set up with the fire rescue service, that is actually purely trading with the commercial sector. I haven't found one. If you know of one, tell me. Most of them hold contracts with the public sector and trade with the public sector. What we've just done in Cleveland is we've set up a trading company to take advantage of the growing commercial chemical industry in Teesside, and they've got an 11, the plan is to generate £11.2 million worth of income in 5 years' time, by 5 years, so it scales up, from the provision of enhanced fire emergency services in these chemical companies, because they all want, they're only on-site firemen, fire engines. At the moment, they either grow their own or they buy them in from the commercial sector. And basically, the buy-in is that these companies get, we at the moment, what we're doing is employing firemen in their off-duty time on 0 hours contracts, because most firemen have other jobs apart from their regular job. So instead of them going off somewhere else to do that job, we're employing them. We're using the skills that they've developed in their mainstream fire role, because they've got to have those skills anyway, and deploying them into these contracts. No problems getting them deployed in. They're queued up to sign up. We charge the company that's receiving the services a cost for the service. We charge them a management fee to account for the overheads, and then we get them to make a contribution to the community fund, which is 15% of their overall contract. And then we make it really, really clear what they're trying to do. So what they're trying to do is Cleveland Fire Authority, or Cleveland Fire Brigade, are trying to keep people in jobs, because if they don't, they're going to have to let people go in 5 years' time. They're trying to stimulate jobs in their local community, because if they get more of these chemical industries up, running and working and safe, then local people will have local jobs, and it will reduce their insurance risk in these chemical companies because they've got a gold standard service, so hopefully more companies will come into Teesside and set up. And the surplus, we've said it was a community interest company, even though it's limited by guarantee of the fire authority. The surplus is redistributed back into the delivery of discretionary services into the brigade. Not statutory services, discretionary services. Go on.
Just a health and safety issue worries me about that.
All the health and safety risks are all covered?
No, because getting people to do more than one job.
Oh, well, it's monitored tightly. So they're absolutely strict with working time regulations. But these firemen, in their spare time now, will go and have other jobs. And there have got no way in which they can monitor that whatsoever. Whereas this way, at least, they can monitor that.
And their contracts allow them to have other jobs? Because in local authorities, there's still rules that you can't have other jobs.
Firemen. Do your firemen not have other jobs?
God. Well, ours do. Yeah. Some work at Tesco's and then
they're taking fire. So this is a spin out.
It's a local authority. It's a fire authority trading company.
Which will work
it's
only
wholly
with
owned,
private sector clients.
It's wholly owned by the fire authority.
Right.
So it's a company limited by community interest company limited by guarantee, and the only reason it can happen is because it's got a market.
Yeah.
Mm. All right. So it wouldn't happen. You know, could you do it in the middle of Hammersmith and Fulham? I don't know what the industry's like. You can do it there. So the challenges with that is that's great and it's going to work. All right. But it's wholly owned by the fire authority. Because it's wholly owned by the fire authority, it is subject to all the same levels of scrutiny as the public sector, which means that we have to build in all the same mechanisms and accountability frameworks as you do in the public sector. Where we're going with it next is to see if we can move it to there, to get it operating, get them developing their commercial skills, see whether they can trade, and then see if they can let themselves loose into a different enterprise. Still means that ownership, because we can make it a company limited by shares, can be a shareholder, could be the local authority or the fire authority. There is nothing to stop that from happening. So the key, Ronnie, it's back onto accountability. The key of all of this is that there are mechanisms you can use. And when we just throw out saying we want to stimulate the social enterprise market, we need to really be clear about what is it we're trying to achieve, and then which governance model allows you to deliver that service safely, to the right quality, to the right price. And someone asked me earlier on about, you know, where do you start with this? And the starting point is you have to have a bottom line on quality. So these guys know, they know with the level of quality that they will deliver. We did a lot of work when they first started on, they did the work. When I say we, it's because we work with them. Is that the first premise was, what's the baseline? You know, how far will we, so if we go into a company and they say, no, we don't want four firemen delivering this particular service, we only want two, then we'll say, no, it's four or it's not. And we really kicked them about, why is it four? Does it need to be four? When do you use four? Do you have to use four 24/7? What does it look like? And we got to the level where we said, that's the bottom line. So if they go in to deliver a contract and they put a proposal together and the chemical industry comes back and says, no, we don't want to do that because we want you to cut the bottom line, they'll say, don't want your business. We're off.
Isn't part of the difficulty, I agree that part of selecting the right model that's going to work is about identifying the needs. Part of the issue is that a lot of the public sector leaders that we're dealing with are approaching this agenda because of the political drive behind it. It is not starting from we're trying to...
No.
For example, if you were trying to start at the other end, it would be even, you know, some of the greatest potential you'd think if you were looking from a public service delivery overall would be to start from the point of view of, you know, what are the unmet needs, or you might start from that point of view rather than even trying to deliver what you're doing in a way.
I haven't come across one member, and people tell me whether they have or not, that will say we're doing this because it's been driven and we've got to set up social enterprises. Every member I've come across says the key imperative at the moment is managing within budget so we don't have to cut services. And how do we do that? How do we deliver services in an efficient way? And about making sure the population get what they want more than what they need, I think, sometimes. Because people will vote with their feet. You know, they vote.
I'm a little bit more.
Yeah.
I know what you say.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think there are members
there
that think this is being driven. They have to be seen to be delivering it.
Right.
Particularly. And I think the other thing is they are very worried about losing control.
Yeah. So
and that is the big issue. That yes, they want to be seen as entrepreneurial, innovative, whatever words you want to use. But at the end of the day, they get voted in on what they deliver.
They do.
They get voted in on waste collection,
yeah.
and they get voted in on planning
yeah.
to district council, not much else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. If you externalise both of those services, what am I voting for?
Yeah.
Why am I voting for you? What exactly do you do?
Yeah.
So I think there is a, and that's the difference between two tiers.
Yeah.
Because if you're in a large livable
unitary
or a county council, it's very different. So a lot of district councils see this as a bad way of getting rid of the districts.
Right. Mm. Okay.
And you would see the Open Services White Paper as wholly non-ideological?
I'm not allowed to comment on government policies.
I mean, having lived through the CCT era, the authorities have resolutely resisted any form of outsourcing or privatisation. I mean, I think there is still an ideology that I don't think it's straight party political any longer, but the whole competition choice contestability is a Whitehall ideology, which has carried on from Blairism and New Labour and still seems deeply ingrained in
so
within Whitehall.
Okay, let's talk about how we get control. Sorry, Teresa.
Yeah, it was about... we're always talking about the market economy.
Yeah, yeah.
So where does the anti-capitalism campaign fit in all this?
I wouldn't answer if I don't know.
Is the market economy the only ball game in town? Is that what you're saying?
No, I suppose what I'm saying is, as a citizen, I want to know when I access, if I need a public service, be that my bins, be that whatever, and I'm paying for it, I want a blooming good service. And, you know, if that means I'm going to get that service from a company that's going to make profit, then I want to be able to make that choice if they deliver me a blooming good service. If I'm ill or I need something that's publicly funded, I want to be able to access that service when I need it. That's what I pay for.
Yeah, but equally, you don't want that service run on market principles whereby, as you say, your electricity company or your utility company phones you endlessly saying, would you like this deal or that deal?
Yeah, yeah.
And I say to them, if you can put it in an email, I will look at it, but I'm not prepared to do this stuff over the phone.
Absolutely.
Because you will just befuddle us all with figures.
Yeah.
And say, they say,
oh
no, we can't. We're only
allowed
to do it over the
phone.
Which is why
I get so passionate about social enterprise, because I don't want to be in that position. Let's just talk about how you exercise control, because I think that's certainly the work we do with councils, that's always the key one, is about control. So, we know why people are interested in control, you know, we don't have to say that. How do you exercise control when something is outside of an organisation?
It's about influence, isn't it? It's all about the circle of influence. Circle of negotiation, being clear on your end outcomes, relationship building, etc., etc. But that still doesn't become control.
Yeah. How do they exercise control at the moment? Yeah, by not passing things or by saying, okay. So, some of the challenge with this, I think, is thinking about one exercise we try and do with people is say, when you're looking at a service, is for that particular service, is think about the level of risk and think about the level of control that is required for that service. So planning. You know, if planning is a major, major issue in your local area and it's got a high level of risk attached to it and you need a high level of control, the further away that gets from your parent body, the riskier it is, the harder it is to control. Okay, so would you choose planning to do the first thing? No. Okay. So there's a trick to play in terms of, you know, if it's fundamentally risky and you've got to have that control, then don't do this. You know, keep it in-house, deal what you've got to deal with. But if you've got to balance that against cost and quality, then sometimes the conversation needs to be about, okay, here's the issue of risk and control, here's the risk of quality, how do we balance that? And actually, we might need to make some difficult decisions. And some brave councils will do it, and some won't. I mean, Hammersmith and Fulham have done loads of stuff, haven't they, with K&C and Westminster?
They won't surrender political sovereignty on planning. control decisions, because they've been very clear from the start that that is a political decision-making process very essential to their citizens. Yeah.
And one of the things we do when we first go in to talk about options appraisals is to say, what's off the table? So for this particular service, I've talked to someone this morning around adult social care, and I've said, right, okay, what's, have you spoken to your members, your cabinet? Yes, right, what's on and off the table? Because if, you know, if we know it's off the table, there's no point in even looking at it, because you'll get it into cabinet and it'll just get thrown out. You'll have done 6 months of work, it'll be thrown out. So there's no point even going there. Go for something that you know will work in the first instance, unless you can come with an absolute coherent story around cost and quality, and you demonstrate to them how they can keep, how they can manage risk and maintain control in a different way, but the main benefit is about cost and quality. And that's a really difficult act, and the only way to get that through when you're dealing with something that's really tricky is wean them through it all the way through the journey. So members, those, or those people making the decisions, are key stakeholders, and the last thing you should do is what I call the ta-da model, which is, you know, you go into cabinet with your paper after spending 2 years of putting together your options appraisal, and then all of a sudden you go to cabinet and you go, ta-da, in local authorities and other public bodies that have spent ages beavering away, putting together a business plan, which is really difficult, done it all on their own, got all the staff engaged, they go to cabinet and cabinet say, well, we've got plans for this service. Entrepreneurial spirit in local authorities and other public bodies that have spent ages beavering away, putting together a business plan, which is really difficult, done it all on their own, got all the staff engaged, they go to cabinet and cabinet say, well, we've got plans. And they go, and nothing happens, or it gets chucked out, and you go away disenchanted. And we come across a lot of people who, you know, entrepreneurial spirit in local authorities and other public bodies, that have spent ages beavering away, putting together a business plan, which is really difficult, done it all on their own, got all the staff engaged, they go to entrepreneurial spirit in local authorities and other public bodies that have spent ages beavering away, putting together a business plan, which is really difficult, done it all on their own, got all the staff engaged, they go to cabinet and cabinet say, well, we've got plans. Entrepreneurial spirit in local authorities and other public bodies that have spent ages beavering away, putting together a business plan, which is really difficult, done it all on their own, got all the staff engaged, they go to cabinet and cabinet say, well, we've got plans. Entrepreneurial spirit in local authorities and other public bodies that have spent ages beavering away, putting together a business plan, which is really difficult, done it all on their own, got all the staff engaged, they go to cabinet and cabinet say, well, we've got plans. In local authorities and other public bodies that have spent ages beavering away, putting together a business plan, which is really difficult, done it all on their own, got all the staff engaged, they go to cabinet and cabinet say, well, we've got plans for this service. In local authorities and other public bodies that have spent ages beavering away, putting together a business plan, which is really difficult, done it all on their own, got all the staff engaged, they go to cabinet and cabinet say, well, we've got plans for this service. In local authorities and other public bodies that have spent ages beavering away, putting together a business plan, which is really difficult, done it all on their own, got all the staff engaged, they go to cabinet and cabinet say, well, we've got plans for this service. We were going to outsource it, or you're not having it. The other thing about risk, which is important, which I didn't think about, and our chief exec told me about it, and it really made me think, was for a council, there's also another issue. If you have a community group that sets up a service as a social enterprise in your area, and it's going great, everything's fine, the population get used to it being there. They don't know that actually that's something different and it's not something you're commissioning. That organisation, either then they get fed up, so the community get fed up with it, or they go, who picks it up? The council.
Because it's by expectations.
Because it's expectations. And that's exactly, again, where your members come. So again, when you're thinking about risks, it's risk to whom and in what situation, and how do you mitigate that risk?
The example about
iPhones, but, you know, it's things like that. It goes back to what someone said earlier on. If you've got the information, sometimes you know how to deal with it better.
But in the case, going back to highways again, a lot of the people left in local authorities may not want them to see.
It goes back to what someone said earlier on. If you've got the information, sometimes you know how to deal with it better.
But in the case, going back to highways again, a lot of the people left in local authorities may not want them to succeed. So when you come to the risk, it is also about the culture of the organisation enabling those private sector companies to succeed. So it is all about culture.
So we've probably come to an end, but there are loads of other things we didn't cover. That's me for the next few months. So, and I'm an ER proctor. If there's anything burning that you want any information about them, feel free to drop me an email. I think I've got one to the left. I'm more than happy to signpost you to people or have a chat about some of the stuff we're doing.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.